Welcome into the Seminole Rap Podcast. I think for the first time in 2022, we've got the full rap crew here. It's your host Brian Peller and Juan Montalvo, John Marchant, all of us here, ready to talk some football today. Welcome back, guys.
How's it going?
We're back.
Yeah, good to be back. I branched out last week and left both of you out after we spared around with one of you, then the other. Then I just said, both of you get out, and we talked baseball and basketball. I ruined the basketball season in the process. So let's just go back to football and bring everybody together.
Is there much to ruin there?
Well, so John and I made fun of it because I declared when me and you came on, John, Juan, earlier in the in January, I said that football's over. We'll figure out something to talk about. Basketball is basically finished. Then when John and I got back on like 2 weeks later, they'd won six in a row since I declared the season over. Then I jumped on with Matt Minnick, one of our basketball guys, and we talked hoops. And the next day, they decided to shut the star down for the season, which we kind of briefly touched on. And then they've pretty much collapsed since. So we stuck the fork in them in two different directions. We uplifted them for six games, and then destroyed the year. So yeah, I think it's just better to go back to football and what we know how to do. If that works for you guys.
Yeah, I don't know basketball from. I mean, first of all, I'm 5'6". I don't belong anywhere near a basketball court.
Yeah. So this week obviously helps out a little bit too, as we wait for spring ball to start. Traditional National Signing Day comes and goes, and we did get the schedule. So I think we've got enough there to kind of keep us busy. And I think the big note for National Signing Day or traditional National Signing Day was Florida State really didn't do anything. But I don't think that's really a problem. Their class does finish 20th overall. If you go with the overall on 247, where they include transfers and high school recruits, they end up at 18, which I believe my quick math a second ago was third best in the conference. No, fourth best behind North Carolina, Clemson, and Miami. But overall, not bad. You're right there, basically neck and neck with Florida. I think they left some room for potential transfers the rest of spring. Any concern on them not bringing anybody in on traditional signing day?
Not really. I mean, obviously you want to be in a position where you can land higher rated guys. And most of them these days really are doing it on the early signing day. They whiffed on three, four, five guys, I guess, depending on who you include in that. I mean, shoot, you know, by 11:30 that morning, they had already lost West and Hunter. So they got their whiffs out of the way on early signing day. The only team that really had a huge amount of notable pickups on signing day was Texas A&M, who took their class from, I think, like from, you know, regular number one overall to the highest rated recruited class of all time, which ended up featuring later that week or whenever it was on signing day, I think, Jimbo Fisher going into a tirade about, yeah, you don't want me to talk about stuff that people are doing in recruiting. You know, I mean, he was getting heated. It was funny. But basically, yeah, we don't pay players. And he's probably not incorrect in that sense. I mean, they don't directly pay players. They have boosters who could literally give them millions of dollars if they wanted to and are doing in certain cases. That's millions with an M, not a B. We're not in succession here.
You'd be surprised with that A&M money.
Yeah, seriously, that oil money. Price of crude is up almost double this year or whatever. So I think it's a really good time to be a Texas A&M guy.
Yeah, I mean, we could stick there for a second if you want. Obviously, Jimbo and A&M bring in the greatest recruiting class in the history of college football recruiting per the metrics here.
Not to USC, not to Alabama, not to Clemson, not to Florida, not to Ohio State, not to any of these traditional powers. But the Texas A&M, I mean, shoot, you got to hand it to Jimbo. I mean, that's a hell of a pull.
Yeah, and he said, you know, which was funny to me, and John, I'll throw this one to you. I don't know if you've even been to College Station. My sister's about to get married there later this year. She's an Aggie herself. But the amount of time I've spent in College Station, I could not imagine picking to go to school there. And Jimbo, his whole tirade was, you know, we're not paying players. But he also was saying, like, because Lane Kiffin was earlier in that week was saying, I don't know how Texas A&M is affording the players they've got without incurring a luxury tax. And so he was railing back to Kiffin, basically like, you know, you know, you can't, everyone's just mad because we're doing it. We're doing NIL better than them, but this doesn't have anything to do with NIL. This is us putting in years of hard work on the phones. I mean, message board rumors, which is what he was railing about, are saying that these, you know, A&M's got trust funds set up for days for these kids to come in. Of course, you know, message board rumors are what they are. But it's no surprise that all of a sudden A&M jumps to the top the minute there's the ability to pay players, and we know A&M's got the deep pockets. But recruiting is what Jimbo does.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, from a purely nonpartisan standpoint, I guess, I think that the decision Jimbo Fisher made to leave Florida State was a fantastic one for him. I think he saw the writing on the wall in the future of the sport to a certain extent. It's just weird for me because, I mean, when I started following college football, Texas A&M's never been anything, right? They've
still
been a perennial, right, exactly, a perennial 5-8 win team forever. I've never been to College Station. I have been to Austin. If I had been born in Texas, I could have definitely seen myself going there. But, and I'm not a big fan of the state of Texas in general, but Austin is amazing. But no, seriously, I think, I mean, the game has changed, right? This whole thing about NIL and stuff, it's just, it's not different than before. They're just being paid above the table now, in my opinion. But it added another layer to the sports arms race, right? You know, it's not just because now that it is above the table, it's not, hey, they're going 60 and a 50, or they're going 70 and a 60, 65 or whatever. This is as fast as you can go in plain sight, right? There's no one cares anymore. There's no one to regulate it anymore. So, because the NCAA has basically ceded all authority in this matter. So, you know, whatever Jimbo says, it doesn't really matter to me. But I do think A&M, do we consider them a new power at this point, a powerhouse? I think so, right? How can you not? Especially going forward, only these schools that are like A&M that have this kind of money, they're going to be the big winners of the whole NIL era until there's something, whether congressional legislation or whatever replaces the NCAA, the Power Five breaks away and they make their own constitution, whatever that looks like. I think this is the new future, and it's here, and it includes schools like A&M.
Yeah, John, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, they may not be considered a traditional power in any sense, but I mean, look, Jimbo's right to some degree. You do land the top rated class by having one of the best staffs and recruiters. Doesn't hurt to have a huge fund, a slush yeah. fund out there where you right. can bring people in. I get his point that, you know, you don't want to demean the work that his coaching staff is and, you know, the kids on the team have done to get those guys to come to College Station. Not that those visits weren't paid for, but you get my point. And I'm not talking official visits. I mean, you're talking probably six figures for most of those top 10 kids in that class that they got. Or the top 10 kids in their class, not the top 10 overall guys. But my favorite thing with the whole Jimbo thing was him talking about Bro Bible. The exact quote from Jimbo was that the NIL doesn't affect recruiting at all. This $30 million thing is a joke. They had this idea, there's some fund out there, and it was written on a site called Bro Bible by a guy named Sliced Bread, and all of a sudden the cult country believes it. And he was just, you know, getting really, really feisty, Jimbo, which is to me always fun. I always enjoyed that side of Jimbo.
I like that. Was that your fake Jimbo? That was pretty good.
I didn't go full in. I mean, I could really talk like the West Virginia Jimbo if you really want to, but that wasn't my best one. But I don't do a bad Jimbo. I've listened to quite a lot of that, man, over the years with the Monday press conferences and all that.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was good. It had the right amount of twang to it. I as someone, like I said, has been to College Station enough. Austin makes Austin looks like Shanghai compared to College Station. It's a 4 or 5 red light type town, and all of a sudden, you know, they're bringing in more 5 stars in one class than they've brought in the last 10 years. So, you know, I mean, but like you said, what's the difference? It's the NIL era. Does it change anything? And I know we wanted to have the deeper conversation. I think that's going to be coming up soon. And hopefully we can get a good interview here coming up for you guys in the next few weeks, talking about Florida State's role in that. Anything else you want? You know, I mean, like I said, I obviously we were, I think, more pleased in the last few weeks with their work in the transfer portal than in the actual high school recruiting. And I think for where Florida State is, that makes more sense than it is to just force in an extra kid or two on what's left of a traditional day.
Yeah, I mean, look, I still think nothing's really changed my opinion that the transfer portal is still something like a free agency. There's a little bit of luck involved, a little bit of a lottery. I do think, though, that Norvell have time to think about it. He's had more success than not in the portal, obviously. And I think that's a good sign. I am a little disappointed with the class overall, just because it didn't quite meet what I thought. But again, I know that it raises the floor and the overall talent level of the program, and that's what you want. So it's a step in the right direction. It's just going a little bit slower than what I had expected or the benchmark that I personally had set for the program. But I don't think there's anything, like I said, to be upset about. It's still moving Florida State in the right direction. Now, I know going into the season, right, we're talking about you got to get to a bowl game. I'm still at 6 wins. I know some people are saying they got to win 7 or 8 wins, or Norvell's on the hot seat going into 2023. But I'm still just going to keep it as making a bowl game. But like I said, I was a little disappointed, but I don't want people to think that, oh, you know, Norvell's doing a horrific job. Like, he needs to be fired. That I think that's way too it's off base and it's premature.
And go ahead, Jim.
And I do want to agree with John there that, where they are right now, it's not raising the floor of the program enough. It's not, you know, you're getting some decent ceiling players and some decent floor players, but you're not lifting the talent pool nearly enough. I mean, they're way down on talent behind Clemson for sure. They're still behind Miami and Florida by a significant margin. If you look at like the 24/7 team talent composites. And, you know, that's not going to change with this recruiting class. The only way it's going to change significantly is in the next year or so. It looks like it's going to be Miami and Florida coming back down the ladder a little bit. So the one thing I really wanted to talk about that we've seen the last few weeks, and Brian, I'm sure you guys talked a little bit about it last week, but I wanted to talk to you and John about it. They've really reorganized a lot of the back end recruiting staff in the last month or so. You know, you had the early signing day disaster. There's no mild way to put it. You lost Travis Hunter, number one overall recruit to Jackson State, to your most famous alumni of all time, in a very public way to a HCBU, which HBCU or whatever, that really has no business getting a top 250 player, let alone the number one overall player. And, you know, there were murmurs that Norvell was really unhappy with his recruiting staff for how that day turned out. And they were sort of blindsided on a lot of them. I know for a fact they were on Hunter. And so they didn't have as good intel as they wanted. They didn't, you know, close obviously near as well as they need to. But they brought in a few different guys. I mean, you have Derek Ray from Oregon State who came in. He was their director of player personnel, I believe. You had Bruce Warwick move up within the program to, I believe, associate athletic director and vice president of football or something to that effect. I forget the exact title. You had one or two other guys come in, but all three, four, I think, hires that they made in the last month have been a significant improvement. So in the last 2 months, you've seen basically since, you know, early December, you've seen, okay, disaster on signing day, really good portal class in the month following that. And then in the last month or so, you've seen them revamp the recruiting aspect, the back end of the recruiting part of the operation. Some of the guys who have caught some heat from folks out there, the Eric Cantor, guys like that that are part of that recruiting staff, they still are there, it appears. They haven't been pushed out or fired or encouraged to get other roles that we know of. So those guys are still potential liabilities. But you have definitely beefed up that back end. And, you know, it's a good sign that you've got a coach who's willing to make changes and add, you know, capacity where it's clearly needed.
I mean, well, yeah, like a lot of people were upset that he didn't move on from Dugans or even Odell, but he did make changes. I mean, to your point. So it's not like Norvell didn't do anything after, you know, what was a disappointing National Signing Day. Or early signing day, I should say. That's where I'm kind of like, Yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed, but they're still moving in the right direction. You can't say Norvell's not doing anything. You can't say that he's flying blind back there, I guess. I mean, he's obviously identifying what he thinks are the issues and trying to address them. So, you know, I don't really know what else to say. You know, I would have thought he would have maybe been a little bit more thorough going through the staff, but maybe what he's hearing is it wasn't really the staff, the coaching staff, you know, on field guys, it was the back end guys. So I can't. Aspect. Right. Sorry. I'm just saying is I can't second guess from where I'm sitting. Cause I just don't know.
The other aspect of those for two particular coaches, both Dugans and Odell Higgins are obviously, you know, alumni. Odell is loved by both the fan base and, you know, everybody at the Moore Center and all the key boosters. He's a guy that's planning to retire. He has been planning to retire. I don't think he intended to be here this deep into the third coach since Bowden. So yeah, I think he's planning to retire. It's a matter of time. And I don't know that they were able to get that. I believe that they were looking at receiver coaches. I don't think they were able to really make it a move on a guy that they would actually consider to be a significant upgrade to the point where, you know, you'd want to move on from Dugans, who was out of contract, but they gave him a 1-year extension from my understanding. So yeah, it's not ideal to have those two guys still on the staff. I don't think you were ever going to see both of them leave at the same time. It'd be a tough shift to move on two heralded coaches, especially African-Americans, and Odell's a father figure to half the team, that sort of thing. So moving both those guys at once wasn't going to happen. But, you know, I don't think they got the traction they wanted to do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, my brief interactions with both of them out at, I'm trying to remember what it was when they were doing those youth camps across the country. Perry, our producer, site runner, went out, and I went out to their camp in Lakeland, kind of between Orlando and Tampa. And you know, those guys, especially Odell, were you know, basically celebrities. It was the people who the, you know, even the dads, as they were coming up, wanted to take pictures with. You know, so I think that does add the element, makes it a little bit harder to rearrange. And maybe it's the type of thing where you just let them make their own choice on when their time is, if you can't find, you know, a massive upgrade. But like, I think the whole thing still circles around John's point earlier, where if you're Norvell, this becomes that make or break year for you, where, you know, maybe that decision can't, I don't know, maybe that decision is made above his head anyway, but, you know, I don't think he's in a spot where he can pull any punches. He's got to make sure that this year lands at least in that bowl game realm, like we talked about. I feel like he has to get this to six wins to continue. So, I mean, at that, I guess I don't really want to go through the whole schedule line by line, but and go win loss. But just I'll run through it so we're all on the same page where we're at, and we can pick out games we think maybe are the big ones to talk about. You open up, I guess it's week zero if we're still calling it that, with Duquesne at home. It's the Sunday night Labor Day weekend game against LSU in New Orleans. You get your bye week at that point. It's the Friday night game at Louisville. The following week, it's Boston College and Wake Forest at home. Then it's at NC State, home with Clemson. Bye week, Georgia Tech at home, at Miami, at Syracuse. Then it's UL Lafayette. I'll call them that because I want to. And then Florida, you finally get them at home after years and years now with the trips to Gainesville. I don't know why that sounded weird in my head, but anything in there that jumps out to you? I think obviously the two Friday games with the UF game moving to a Friday as well is probably a big talker there. Anything that jumps out in terms of just a game that maybe it looks a little different for you than you expect?
Well, the one that, you know, that we're going to talk about probably in a little bit more detail in a minute is the Florida game. So yeah, we'll just set that aside for a moment. I'm going to sort of flip the script on this a little bit. What do you guys think is the toughest game on the schedule? And what is the easiest easiest real opponent? Let's not include Duquesne or your weaker out of conference teams there.
I think your toughest game is probably, I'm going to go with at NC State. Because it's sandwiched between Wake and Clemson. It's in the same, it's in a five game run in that middle of October realm. I know we've talked about it before where NC State's a tough place for them to go. I haven't seen it released yet, but I did see the early teaser tweet, I believe, from Bill Connolly about the this year's S&P Plus rankings, and he put a GIF of NC State's flag on there saying, oh boy. So I guess the expectation is they're going to be returning a lot of talent, if I'm guessing on what that tweet was saying. So I think that's a team that's going to be tough for them. I don't know. I mean, I want to say Georgia Tech because you're coming off a bye. You get a chance to regroup at that point. Maybe Syracuse, but you're on the road there. I'll go Georgia Tech as the one I think I would put closest to a rental win of the real games.
What do you think, Joe?
I think the toughest game is still Clemson, but I would put NC State right behind them. I think that's obviously the toughest two-game stretch of the season is at NC State and then Clemson. I think the easiest game is Syracuse. I mean, they've kind of slipped even further back from where they were before. They're not very good right now.
I don't know if Dino even makes it to that game.
He probably won't. He probably, I mean, seriously, which he had a really good year with them too. And I thought he was going to, there's just no consistency there with him. I don't think Georgia Tech's going to be very good either, but for me, I think it's Syracuse. I just, until they prove otherwise, I know the gap closed a little bit with Clemson this year, but Uwe Ungalale still, I mean, he's still a significant limiting factor for them, but he obviously, they worked with him as the season went on. He got a little bit better. I think they got better at adjusting to who he was, if I'm being quite honest. And they snapped off a bunch of wins. And then the talent on their defense was still championship level last year. I don't know what it'll be for this coming year, but I still put Clemson as the toughest.
That's fair. I'm going to actually go with Brian's answers on this. Well, Brian's first answer for sure, NC State to me is the toughest place to play in the ACC, and that includes Stoke and Death Valley. I really do believe that. I mean, you know, when they're rocking and going, that is a tough stadium. We've talked about it on the program before, but you know, you have anybody who's been on the sidelines, they'll tell you NC State is as tough as or tougher than the other two. I mean, you need to look no further than Florida State and Clemson's track records, even when they're good in that stadium. I mean, Chris Winkie threw the 6 interception game that was famous back in 98, I believe. And it's just like, that is just a kryptonite place for those guys to play. It's just always has been, and I think it's going to continue to be. And it's a terrible spot in schedule, like you said, a sandwich between Wake and Clemson, which are both home games. So you know, you've got to deal with you know, that it's a sandwich game on the road at NC State. So yeah, that's probably my highest percentage loss just for all those factors. And I know those are generally soft factors, but like Brian was alluding to, they bring back Devin Leary. They bring back a lot of really talented receivers. I saw a receiver coach ranking this week that showed Dugan's top 10, and they barely had the NC State guy in the top 50. I was like, I don't know what crack that person was smoking, but I don't want it because it messes your brain up. But yeah, I think NC State is clearly the toughest spot on the schedule for me. The easiest game, yeah, it's really Georgia Tech or Syracuse. I don't want to say LSU because they look to be righting the ship a little bit. The dance moves may not always pay off. Brian Kelly missed a recruiter too, despite grinding on them. So we'll see how that turns out. But I think, yeah, if I had a gun to my head, I'd probably go Cuse.
Yeah, and I think when you look at the schedule overall, my biggest concern is, like we talked about, I know after last year, you don't want to put anything in a rent-a-win category, but I think you can do that with Duquesne. If you want to put UL there, Louisiana Lafayette, Raging Cajuns, they're a November 19th game for you. They've been very good in the last 5 years, obviously under Billy Napier, who's now Florida's coach.
Yeah, we played them on a Friday, actually, in the end of November, I believe, is when the Louisiana game is.
I've got it as Saturday the 19th, but regardless,
you're missing the point. He brought half the staff, like 10 transfers from to Florida or whatever the heck it is. Well, Lafayette East.
My point for UL is going to be the the main cog for them has been, well, last year especially, they won like 8-1 possession games. So they weren't really the 12-win team that they were. Their quarterback, who's been like, is like a 6-year senior, 7th-year senior with COVID stuff, is gone. So I know that they're one of the stronger group of five programs as of late, but I wouldn't be concerned there. The concern at game does give me, the way the schedule lays out, is you do get Florida the week after. And I have seen some drama out of Lafayette where the new coach, who was Napier's offensive coordinator, and some of the other members of staff were upset with Napier plucking so many players and coaches from the roster. So maybe there's some animosity, bad blood there, but I would not be surprised if that's almost a practice squad game for Napier's team ahead of the Florida State game, because, you know, he's obviously got great ties with UL, and they get to see your team 6 days before you face the actual coach. It's just something in the layout of the schedule that fell in an interesting way, where you play, I guess the way you called it, UL West, and then the week after you actually get your rival on Friday night of UL East.
I like it.
But there's no real, when you look top to bottom, I mean, like we mentioned, Georgia Tech and Syracuse are probably the weaker ones, but I think every other game, which, you know, for better or for worse, is a possible win or possible loss. I mean, you mentioned LSU, who's righted the ship, and they've done it through a ton of transfers, and they signed a really strong recruiting class, and they're going to get a healthy starting quarterback back this year, assuming health there. But in Louisiana, new coach, I don't think it's an easy one, but it's one you could win. At Louisville, we've seen Louisville look okay at times. Boston College is bringing back a lot. Wake Forest, NC State, Clemson, Miami, Florida. I mean, it's just a bunch of games where I feel like you fall in this clump of hopefully they bounce your way. And that's, I don't know if that's a fun spot to be in if you're Norvell in a year that you kind of have to have it. I feel like you were kind of crossing your fingers and hoping Louisville or Boston College or Wake weren't going to be as good coming into this year to help you pad those numbers. I still think 6-7 wins is attainable, but I've seen, you know, I was reading a roundtable with Perry and them where they were talking about, I think 8-4. And I still think 8-4 has got to be your ceiling.
I think I agree. I actually did a relatively recently, I did a little win share thing. This was after all the transfers have come in, and I did a win shares on Tomahawk Nation's Discord. If you want information on that, we can get it to you. I believe we could probably have someone put it in the post. We'll see if Perry can throw a link in there for us.
Yeah.
But so, you know, the survey that I did there, basically the average came out to about 6.8 wins, which, you know, leads, you know, your three most likely outcomes according to that are 7 wins, 6 wins, then 8 wins, I believe is what it finally worked out to. So you had a fairly optimistic, I think, group in there. Mine came out to like 6.3, 6.4, which, you know, that's fairly close. But you're talking a team that 6 to 8 wins is really, you know, short of I'm going to keep using this phrase I used on the last time I was on the podcast, you know, Scott Frost, bad luck, disaster season, yeah. You know, lose 10 close games by one or whatever. Barring that sort of outcome, 6 to 8 wins is really what you need.
Yeah.
And I expect of the schedule.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, honestly, I think the schedule for the first time in a long time, I'm actually pretty happy with it. I think it overall breaks the right way in a lot of places and sets FSU up to win, go to a bowl game. What was it first time in 4 years?
I think 4.
Good Lord. Yeah, so first time in 4 years. So I expect them to get there. I mean, last year I said I think they win 5, but I hope they win 6. I think this year I'll go, I think they're going to win 6. I hope they go 7. I do agree with you, though, Juan. I do think that 8 wins would be more likely than 5, barring a whole bunch of injury issues or some other kind of issues, what have you. But so I think they'll be okay. It'll be a season that, you know, they can't. If it does break that way, they're not going to, you know, Norvell's guaranteed 2023. And I think that'll be the make or break here for him.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about it before where all it really takes is a Jordan Travis rolled ankle and we're in a totally different season, but assuming health, like you talked about, I think
Hey, you already killed the basketball team. Don't do that to, to football in February.
Do it 8 months before the year starts. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think five is less likely than eight. But you know, I always go back to that makes me laugh is, you know, the ball ain't round. You know, it can bounce any way it wants to, just because it ain't round. It ain't gonna bounce perfectly where you expect it to. And if we're in that collection of ACC teams in the middle, and everybody's got a puncher's chance, all it takes is one bounce the other way, and you are at eight, or maybe, you know, you are at five. I think five obviously is the line, right? He's got to get over six, but I do think this, a reasonable expectation is six. And if you can't get there, then we've got a real conversation there.
I hope we don't get to that point of the conversation. I mean,
right.
I can see where they could, you know, put together a good 2023 recruiting class, and a bad season could, you know, scuttle the project, for lack of a better term, and Mike Norvell, for that matter. But hopefully we don't get to that point. They really need to make a bowl game for a multitude of reasons, none the least being recruiting, obviously. But, I mean, you know, it's been 4 years. I mean, we're on our third head coach, I guess, since our last bowl game, I guess, if you include Odell in that. So, yeah, that's not ideal. You don't want another set of transition classes in there if you can avoid it at all possible. I mean, we've seen what that can do to a roster very quickly.
My one question for you guys, and I want to just program-wise, patience-wise, I think if you look at the back post, like I guess post-second bye schedule, it's Georgia Tech, Miami, at Miami, at Syracuse, UL, and then Florida. And we talked about Georgia Tech, Syracuse, and UL all kind of being in that realm of should be wins. If you get to that first bye at 3-4, do you think the patience around the program exists? Because we saw it kind of, we saw the struggle week to week last year. Obviously the Jacksonville State was a much firmer blow than I think maybe a loss to Wake or a loss to North Carolina State would be. But do you think this program has the patience to go into a bye week at 3-4 and be able to hold, you know, collect itself and be like, look, we've got three wins that should get us to six. Let's go try and take care of our rivals. And maybe we do get to eight. And in a schedule that does set up for the possibility of reeling off five in the row at the end, if you want, but I could see being 3-4 in the bye week and it being a frustrating year already when you've already really gone through the toughest part of your schedule.
Well, I mean, like right off the top of my head, I'd say they'd go 3-2 during that stretch, which would put them at 6-6 in a bowl win. But setting that aside to answer your question, there's a lot of different dynamics at play here. Me personally, I would probably classify myself as two online, and online, they already want Norvell to be fired, right? Yeah. But we consistently hear from a lot of the beat that the boosters understand, like, again, that was going back to Willie Taggart's, one of the mistakes that he made, right, was telling the boosters that Florida State was going to win. And Norvell comes in, he tells them something close to the truth. I think they're going to only win X number of games this year, four or five or whatever the case may be. And I think that's bought him some time. So we keep hearing from the beat that he's being honest with the boosters, and the boosters understand and they're willing to give him more time. While quote unquote online people may consider the fact that he's already on the hot seat. I don't agree with that. So if you're going out of the second bye, like at 3-4 or whatever you're saying was, I think it's hard to say. I don't believe that the boosters would abandon him, especially if Norvell preseason was honest with them about how much the season is also going to struggle. Now, if he comes out and says, yeah, we're going to win eight games, right, and they're sitting at 3-4, going in that stretch where you could reasonably lose to Florida and Miami, that might be an issue. Is that enough to fire him? I don't know, especially if Florida State does go to a bowl game. I think this season for me is one where at the end, it's going to hinge on whether or not they make a bowl game. And I know, again, you got all this dynamic, all these different factors at play, all this other stuff. I think that's the benchmark. He has to make it to a bowl game. If Florida State makes a bowl game, I think he's okay. That it would matter more, in my opinion, for 2023 than it does for this particular season. I'm not sure that, unless there's a complete collapse, right? Florida State only wins 4 or 5 games. I think Norvell's safe.
I agree. I think you put it really well that basically he's done a very, well, I don't know if it's necessarily a great job, but he's done a much better job than Willie Taggart did of setting expectations. And what that's helped with the most is it prevents the cascading issue that Willie Taggart ran into. People were skeptical with that hire for many reasons to begin with. And you got into year 2 and I mean, they looked terrible. You know, there was no discernible improvement. And the biggest issue, it wasn't losing to Miami. It wasn't being a losing team. The biggest issue Willie Taggart had was the donors didn't fulfill their promises. That's how bad the program confidence had gotten. It's people didn't want to actually pay what they had pledged. And that happens. You know, I mean, I think there's like a 10 to 20% rate normally is if I remember correctly, of unfulfilled pledges that they allow for, you know, financially. But it was like closer to 40% that time in that season. So it was financially untenable to keep Willie Taggart. I don't think you'll see that same effect because Norvell has done a much better job setting those expectations and, other reasons. I mean, they've had some good wins. I mean, obviously Jacksonville State losses, worst loss in program history. I think we'll give him a longer leash than Taggart. Taggart, I mean, jumped into that leash and hung himself. So, he's like my dog trying to take him on a walk. He's going to try to rip his shoulder off with his neck. It's just, you know, Taggart did not set himself up for success, and Norvell is setting everybody up for the mediocrity a little bit better than Taggart did.
And I think that's fair. I don't want to be trying to paint this Debbie Downer because it's, as we talked about, it's entirely possible they come through that stretch 4-3 or 5-2, and you're looking at a totally different year. Where that 8-4 is possible. So I was just curious on where we thought they stood. I think with the roster where they have, I think that it is on the rise, and I don't anticipate many important players leaving in this upcoming stretch. I think they'll still be adding talent through spring, and that gives them the ability to maybe be even better than we anticipate roster wise. Maybe not, that won't make a full win or loss record change, but I just don't want to be Debbie Downer there. I think, and rain on the parade. I still think the program's heading the right way. Just generally curious there. Anything else you guys on the schedule want to talk about? I guess Florida, the big one's Florida, right? Florida on a Friday now.
I like it.
Any thoughts, concerns?
I want that to be an annual thing. We haven't seen it play out yet, but having the unique game time gives you exposure that you'd never get otherwise. A lot of high school football teams are done at that point. So you're the only game on TV. They don't have school that week, recruits or, fans or whomever. So you've got a prime time spot on a unique night. And so you're going to be on national TV, whether that's ABC or ESPN, kids will be able to watch it. And you have the opportunity to showcase a win over your rival. And that's something that, hopefully will be benefiting Florida State this year. But, it's beneficial for both programs to have that exposure. I think, you're going to get the entire West Coast is going to be watching that game because it'll be, 5 to 8 p.m. or whatever over there. I think there's no downside to this. A lot of people obviously, it messes with travel a little bit, I'm sure. But you know what? I mean, it's something that could really help the program long term, I believe. I'm firmly in favor of starting a Friday tradition for that game.
I don't really have any issue with it. I saw a lot of people again online who thought it was
common denominator there.
Yeah. Who thought it was bad. I really don't have an opinion one way or the other. Some people thought it might cost the local businesses some money. Again, it doesn't really bother me one way or the other. I don't think it's that big of an issue. I do think the risk reward is worth it for Florida State based on where the program is right now. So that's kind of where I'm sitting with it. It just, it doesn't move the needle enough for me to be like, oh, this is, sacrilege, or it doesn't,
John, we need a hot take. You got to get something fresh out the kitchen. Just go ham on it.
They should put the UF game on Thanksgiving Day. How about that? Do it Thursday.
Screw Egg the Bowl's Cowboys. Already got it.
Screw the Cowboys. They're horrible anyway. No one cares. Florida State. Thanksgiving. There's my hot take.
It gives Lions fans something to do that's a little bit better too.
Seriously, all those NFL games are terrible anyway. Just put college on. College is usually better anyway.
That's the spot the Egg Bowl is carved out. The Ole Miss Mississippi State game is let's just go and be messy on Thanksgiving night, and I'm sure it's plenty of fights.
Always the sloppiest game, and it's always so. It's not even fun to watch half the time anymore.
No, it's disgusting.
It's bad. It is disgusting. Really. I hope that's not what the Friday thing turns into for Florida State. I don't think it is. I don't think it will be. But yeah, let's not turn this into the Egg Bowl Part Two.
Well, I think the big benefits, especially, and LSU used to do this a lot. So they played Arkansas on that Friday after, and that has since died since we switched our rival to A&M since they joined the conference. But I really enjoyed it, mostly because it was mostly me growing up. But I'm 27, almost 28 now. But I it was an excuse to not go to the mall with my mom on Black Friday and go to the game or whatever. The big complaint I heard, so that might be great for you guys with the. With the wife, maybe, no, honey, the game's on. I can't go today. And that gives you a built-in excuse as long as you're capable of winning that argument. But I guess the big concern that LSU used to voice was an issue getting students to go to that game because a lot of them were going home for Thanksgiving, which oftentimes just ended with them making that as an optional game on their season ticket package. And they just sold the extra space as regular tickets. And I never felt like the games were lightly attended. LSU and Arkansas was always a fun game. Obviously, this one is probably more of a rivalry, which makes it more fun. You're more likely to still have your cousin who's a UF grad or just a Florida fan because he lives in the central part of the state. And, I think this lends itself to just being more fun and allows you to do more fun things where you're as a fan, have to be fun with it. And if you're a program, like you said, you get a primetime position to play an important game with your rival. And hell, even if you're 5-6 going to this game like last year, it's a prime time spot to do that drunken game where you both are bludgeoning each other over the head as opposed to a noon kick where it's a Saturday and maybe, we don't feel like getting up, whatever. You can almost guarantee yourself a prime time spot on this Friday.
Yeah, so. It's a bigger platform to be disgusting. Let's just...
Help gross you out from those Thanksgiving leftovers quicker.
Well, it's either be part of just all the wash of Rivalry Saturday. You're just another rivalry game in the midst of all this just, I don't know, whatever. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. But
then you get to stand alone as a solitary can of garbage just all by yourself, beaming in the sunshine, right?
Yeah.
No? Well, I'm kidding, but I think it's great. I don't see any issue with it. Like I said, I think the risk reward is more than worth it for Florida State. You beat Florida primetime right now where you are in a program. That gives you a ton of momentum going into early signing day, right? So what do you really have to lose, right? So
yeah. And you joked about it being the beaming trash can out in the open by itself, but that's what the Egg Bowl is. I remember, was it Elijah Moore peeing in the end, pretending to be a dog peeing in the end zone that cost them the, if that happens on a regular Saturday at noon, it's kind of like, haha, I saw it on Twitter, but everyone, college football on Twitter had a great time together laughing at a guy pretending to be a dog costing his team a game.
That's the beauty of college football. Florida, Dan Mullen's tenure at Florida effectively ended when the dude threw the shoe. against LSU that one year. It's just, you don't hear stuff like that in the NFL. Antonio Brown took his shirt off and quit in the middle of the game. That's ridiculous. It's a selfish, dumb kid thing. And he's not even one of the kids. In college football, you got a kid losing the game by pissing. it's just, or losing a program's trajectory by throwing a shoe. It's just a different type of sport. And, we certainly don't watch it because the play is, lights out better. It's because it's just more fun. And part of that is the pageantry. It's the rivalries, the tradition. Okay, great. The Cowboys are playing the Steelers or whoever the hell their rivals are, or the Eagles or whatever. But great. So what's going to happen? It's not that exciting. The Cowboys are going to lose Thanksgiving anyway. And, you know, the beauty of college football is those rivalry games. You know, I mean, the 2003 game, the Swindle of the Swamp, that is what the Gators call it, the Chris Ricks PK Sam throw, where the German Shepherd, the I think the Alachua County Sheriff's Officer was holding and very loosely to sort of let him get at PK Sam. You had like a dog nearly attack the dude after scoring the winning touchdown in the game. Like, the stuff that happens in college football is just so much more entertaining for me. It's just a different game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Purely tribal.
Let's lake it. Let's make it shine. Let's let it be our ugly thing where Brian Kelly's grinding on players.
Throw all the lighter fluid on that dumpster and light it up, baby.
It's our dumpster fire.
Like, no one could ever imagine Jason Garrett grinding on a player, right?
Or, yeah, well,
like, it's only college football. I mean, the shenanigans, it's just, there's nothing else like it. So,
yeah. Well, you know, like we talked about it, we briefly mentioned it, the kids end up, that kid ended up going to Alabama instead of LSU anyway. But then they ended up getting the number one linebacker in the country who said, yeah, I saw the video. And it made me realize, you know, hey, Coach Kelly, I was like, I was there. Coach Kelly was kind of fun. I thought he was a stiff, you know, bored, and he was actually kind of fun, which in reality was probably NIL. But hey, you know, I guess whatever. You know, and like I all said, right, slice I think before, bread. Yeah, sliced bread, bro, Bible. You know, so I think we'll get into that. Was my limited fake Jimbo Fisher. So, you know, we'll get it. I think we'll have that NIL conversation coming up here in the next couple of weeks. I know we're trying to get an interview to talk about Florida State's NIL future and a lot more around the program here coming up. So I think we've got a lot of good stuff, hopefully coming the rest of this month to get you some fun episodes as we still wait for spring ball to start and really dive into the team itself. But I guess for now,
I think we've got a few good guests lined up that we're planning. We're not going to announce them yet. Neil deGrasse Tyson's going to be joining us. Jason Garrett said he'd give me a text or a call. We are working to see which of the coaches we can get for the podcast, which of the, you know, staff folks. We've had Mike Alford on other parts of the Tomahawk Nation media sphere, so to speak.
Yeah, we're working on trying to line up our schedules with him for potentially talking with him here as well.
Yep. So we hope to have him on soon, as well as some of the coaching staff, and then other folks around the program. You know, the we had Kenyatta Watson, I believe, on triple option for the 3 stars. I forget which program.
So we're, you know, if we don't trying. Have
those guys, you can check them out on the other Tomahawk Nation media.
I think all of us are hustling to fill the time slots and get you guys something fun.
Well, I'll tell you what, Marvin Jones doesn't return my damn texts, but I'll retract that if he finally does. One more thing before we call the wrap, though. We need to get at maybe the beginning of every episode now. Perry's got to play that like 5-second clip from Jimbo, like a guy on a site called Bro Bible, some guy named Slice Bread. I mean, just that's got to be at the front of every episode now, because that's the best of college football right there.
Can we get John's impression?
No, sorry, but I agree with Juan. I agree with Juan. I will give my last word too. I don't care what recruiting class Jimbo Fisher gets. The West still runs through Nick Saban until he decides to retire. I know I'm known for like all the hot takes, but you know.
No, I agree.
Warm there.
I gotta see Jimbo win something at A&M before I take them seriously. They have that knack for falling on their face. Bro Bible.
here's to 9-3.
Ooh, that's the best thing ever. Sliced bread. Oh my God. All right,
that's a wrap.
Site called Bro Bible by a guy named Slice Bread.